From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a church when a mother handed her daughter a pencil and encouraged her to draw, to keep her quiet, really. The small gesture was the spark of a lifelong love of art and a career as a visual artist. And that little girl was Atisha Benjamin. She told the Daily News Online in June that her mother consistently praised her artwork and affirmed her abilities. She, along with Benjamin's middle school art teacher, inspired her to pursue a career as an artist. So today, Atisha is a painter, a ceramics artist, a creative consultant, and a professor of art at Monroe Community College. According to a 2014 report by a collective called BFA, MFA, PhD, out of 2 million arts grads nationally, 2 million, only about 10%, 200,000, make their primary earnings as working artists. Think about that number again. In this country, there's more than 2 million people with arts degrees, arts graduates, but about 10% make their primary living from art. Why is that? What does it take to be an artist in 2019? Well, we explore those questions this hour with artists in a variety of media. They join us in advance of the upcoming Flower City Pottery Invitational, an annual event that brings ceramic artists from across the country to Rochester. I'd like to welcome our guests in studio, and Atisha is here. Atisha Benjamin, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And thanks for being here to share your story. Chris Charles is here. Chris is a printmaker, graphic designer, and an art instructor. Welcome to you, Chris. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly Justice is a ceramics artist, studio manager at Flower City Art Center. Welcome, Kelly.
Thank you.
And Peter Pincus is a ceramics artist and a professor of ceramics at RIT. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And on the line with us is Ben Carter, a ceramics artist and host of the Tales of the Red Clay Rambler podcast. Welcome, Ben. How are you?
Good, Evan. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let me just kind of start with that broad question of that, to me, what was a shocking number, and maybe it's not to artists, but when you look at 2 million people in this country who are arts graduates and only about 10% are using that, essentially the degree, the training, the teaching for their primary living, Ben, I'll start with you. Should we be surprised? Are you surprised at that?
You know, I'm not surprised at that statistic, but I would say that there are folks that probably got those arts degrees that use some sort of problem solving that they learned through their arts degree in their daily lives, even if they're not technically being employed as artists. So I think that that statistic is a little grimmer than I would hope it to be.
Atisha, how do you feel about that number?
I feel that that is right on point. And, you know, students go into art school as idealists. Everyone wants to be the artist that's making a living off of their work. And then they come out, they graduate, and they realize there aren't enough jobs to sustain all of them. You know, for example, graphic designers, people would say they're sort of a dime a dozen. There are a whole lot more jobs out there than there are graduating graphic designers. You know, but hopefully they can, or actually it's the opposite. There are a lot more graphic designers than there are jobs, actually, is what I mean. So hopefully they can use those, you know, the problem-solving skills that they learned, even if they're not exactly in the field and creating as they want to.
Would you tell students today, get that arts degree, do it?
Get the arts degree if that's really where your passion is. You know, and if you're trying to, you know, get into a program that's going to sustain you completely financially, then you're probably going to be a little bit empty and feeling like, you know, well, I'm not doing exactly what I love. So it's sort of six of one, half dozen of the other.
Chris, any surprise at those numbers?
No. And I graduated from art school a long time ago, is 1995. And back then, at least, there were no business classes or anything that really, I don't know, gave me some idea of how I would make a living as an artist. And I didn't for many, many years. I've only been full-time for about 4 years. So that's a pretty big gap in there.
Did you feel like you were not prepared enough for the realities of the struggle that artists could face at the time?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was a painting major originally, and I mean, they kind of said, well, just keep painting and show your slides to a gallery, and maybe someday that gallery will pick you up. And that was that was it.
That was the advice
I got, yeah.
I can't imagine that's generally the counsel that students get now.
I would hope it's a whole lot better now. But I still do think that sometimes the business side of things is not emphasized enough. And that's important to making a living as well.
Okay. Yeah. Kelly, any surprise with those numbers?
Not really. They sound about right. Although I will say I was the opposite and that I didn't start out going to art school. I actually got a degree in English and then didn't really know what I wanted to do as a career and then fell in love with clay after that and decided that that was what I wanted to pursue.
Okay. And would you tell students now, do it, it's worth it, arts degree?
If you love it, absolutely.
Okay. Peter?
Well, as an educator, it is my job to not only be aware of what you said, but also to find ways to help prepare people for this career, even though those statistics are what they are. And I've always been of the mindset that it is you can make a lot of money in the field of art, given the right circumstances, the right education, and the right level of interest. But despite that, my colleague Jane Schellenbarger and I work really hard with our students to have them not only think about that, so not only think about the money, but also think about what these three have said and what Ben said, which is that it's a career that is a lifestyle. It isn't a career that is just about money. And so the only way you can really be sustainable in this career is by having it sort of a deep interest that's founded on your own education.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you think about just the vocation or the career of an artist. The word struggling is often to attach to it. You don't often hear about struggling hedge fund managers or, you know, struggling financial analysts. But so maybe we shouldn't be all that surprised at the number. But as we get ready to talk about what's going to come our way with the 5th Annual Flower City Pottery Invitational, I want to ask if our guests think that those numbers could flip ever in the future, or if this is the reality that is likely to be this way for artists going forward. And I'll start with you, Ben. I mean, I don't know if 10% is normal or average or what you would expect in sort of in perpetuity as until climate change gets us, or you know, or if you think that, you know, certain parts of our country could do better at supporting artists, you know, whether it's Rochester as an arts town that sometimes buys art but doesn't buy enough art to support a lot of artists. I mean, could that number change? Could we see more graduates actually sustain their career through their art, Ben?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's two parts to this. I think that we could do better with city, state, and federal funding for the arts because they are such a culturally valuable part of our society. But also think that the number might go up because artists themselves are learning how to diversify and create income streams that they probably would not have had maybe 20 years ago before the internet. So I think actually the internet itself allows people to have various streams of income, for instance, selling directly online versus selling to a gallery that might make them more successful in the long term.
Okay. Atisha, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think coming up soon in the near future, that the skills that art students develop, spontaneity, ability to see the whole picture, I think those skills will be more in demand. You know, what somebody wants in terms of like the object, you know, that's sort of up to the person, up to the buyer, up to the purchaser. Utilitarian objects, of course, those stand a better chance than, you know, a 4-foot by 6-foot painting. But I think as we're coming up into this age of automation and robots, basically we're going to be competing with robots for jobs. You know, my kids coming up, those kids in high school and college now. So I really feel that as those jobs that are more tech jobs are more automated going down that road, the right brain, more, right brain, more creative ways of thinking are going to be more in demand. So maybe not the objects that artists create, but the ways that they think will be, I think, again, more in demand.
Well, as I turn the question to Chris, I will say that I just got an email from Nick who says, you have a panel full of people with arts degrees, and the first thing you do is ask them a math question. That's a stereotype, Nick. They can do math.
Love math, actually. I almost went into engineering instead of art school. So.
No, Nick says keep up the great work and wants to support everyone here. But when it comes to doing some of those numbers, do you see them? Can you see them changing, Chris? Would you be surprised?
Yeah, absolutely. Nick, and I think everything that has been said so far is absolutely true. I think more support from our communities and educating the audiences that are buying to the value of art, and absolutely the skills that we have just as thinkers and that creative thinking is paramount. Yeah, I think that's going to be a huge asset.
Okay, Kelly?
Yeah, I agree with everything that's been said.
You think we could see 10%? We could see a quarter of the people with arts degrees in this country making their living, not 10%?
Making their full-time living?
Yes, that's
like completely 100% supporting themselves?
Yes.
I don't know. It's difficult. A quarter does seem pretty high. But I think people will always be doing art in some way or another. I mean, I'm not a person who's able to support myself full-time yet with my art. I hope to get there eventually. But throughout my entire life, I'll be doing it in some way or another.
Sure. Peter?
Well, I think it's important to differentiate that 10% from the amount of people who are using their degree and in the ways they are using their degree. I received both my BFA and MFA, but had no interest in supporting myself off of my work. And coincidentally, now my primary income is from the work and my supplemental income is from teaching. And so my wife and I talk constantly about what it would be like if I was not at RIT teaching and instead if we just had a career making work, which we do in the studio together. But there's something that's deeply satisfying about having this other element to the career. And I think a lot of people who get these degrees but don't necessarily sell art for a living still engage in artistic practice while at the same time use the skills they've earned for creative problem solving in a myriad of other very fulfilling careers. So it is, I could at some point see it increasing from 10 to 20% because of the insurgence, like the reemergence of craft in the 21st century and artistic practice being sort of connected to living, and then social media being a platform to help sell things and gain connectivity with galleries.
Sure, perhaps coupled, as Ben said, maybe with a little bit more robust funding at different levels. No, that's interesting. And I think all of your individual stories will be instructive for our listeners, especially for people who are thinking about careers, because I recently met a guy at a party who introduced himself as an artist and then paused and said, "So I'm a bartender." And so we kind of left. And how you get to the point where you're really promoting and moving your work. I'll start with you, Peter. Let's go back around the table. You know, you just mentioned kind of where your income is coming from. I know you sell your art online and through galleries. How do you go about moving your work and making money as an artist?
Yeah, so I do a few things. As you know, I teach at RIT. I also teach workshops throughout the country and alongside Mr. Ben Carter. Then in terms of selling my work, I sell both directly through Instagram and social media and email for objects between $100 and $1,000. And then anything beyond that goes into the gallery system. And so that's usually exhibition-based and project-based with different galleries.
How hard is it to get public awareness that your stuff is there, that people can find it through?
It's simple. So
it's simple.
If I, say, post on Monday that I will have a cup sale, then I have a following of people that will know and will anticipate and then might purchase that work.
Do you expect it to move if you make that? You do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was it that like that right out of the gate, or did it take some time to build that?
Well, I never, as I said, I didn't really have an interest in selling work for the first 15 years of my career. It was just I was interested in being in the classroom, being in the studio. And so when things started to transition, I opened an account on Instagram. The interest was there relatively quickly. And I found that for the type of work that my wife, Lori, and I make, it's very labor intensive. And so even a cup, which seems expensive maybe to people listening, that's say $400, we can't sell that cup through a gallery because we can't only make $200 for the amount of labor we've put into it. So naturally, I just tried to find a way to sell it directly and to do it in an efficient manner. And so that was social media. And so you post the image and then people see the image and then they connect with you about purchasing it.
Okay. Kelly Justice, again, I'm reading that you sell your art online and through galleries as well. How do you try to, you know, if you're on that road to eventually having your art support you full time, if that's going to work out, how do you think you're going to get there?
Well, Instagram, actually, like Peter was saying, has been surprisingly helpful. I've been working the last couple years on really focusing on my social media presence. And I would say maybe in the last 2 years, the work has started to sell through Instagram. So recently I've had a couple of online sales where I'll post a photo of some cups that I'm working on, let people know they're going to be available. And then it's been pretty effective.
When you started doing that, did it take some time to move any of the pieces?
Yes.
So do you remember the first one? You're going, well, We got one. We got one here. This is moving.
The first real sale that I did was last Christmas. And I had done a few posts leading up to the sale. And then surprisingly, everything sold within a week. So I was very pleasantly surprised by that.
What was that like? I mean, was that a sign to you that this is going to happen, that it's going to take some time, but this is the right way to do it?
Yeah, it was exciting. I wasn't sure how it would go, and then everything sold, and I was, like I said, pretty shocked.
Oh, that's great.
So it made me feel like I was on the right track.
Chris, just do some painting, and eventually it'll work out, like right? I told you in school. What's been that path to kind of getting toward a way for art to support you?
I bring in the vast majority of my income from doing art fairs. So I travel around the country, schlep in my tent and my work and set up for the weekend and sell that way. I do sell online as well. I do a little bit with social media. I'm still really trying to build that community, and I've really been trying to gather like emails for an email list and try to stay on top of that. I find it very difficult to keep up with when I'm traveling so much, but it's getting there. It's happening a little more slowly than I'd like, but
you make poster art for musicians?
I do.
How did you get that gig?
Awesome. Well, my friend that owns Abilene was bringing on in all these great bands, and I just said, can I make some free posters? I really like that artist. So I started doing that, and a couple of them actually hired me outright to do work for them. These days, I don't do as many because I'm so busy doing my own work, but I still do a poster for Elin Jewell every time she has an album come out. She's wonderful. So
that's great.
Yeah, it's a really fun project.
Well, Atisha, you told the Daily News Online in June that your art is a continuous and ongoing evolution. So
yes.
How have you pursued art as sort of a way to be an income stream?
Right. So that's why I'm confused as to why I'm on this panel, because I haven't made any money. Actually, I won't say that. I've made several sales. You know, but again, my main work is large figurative paintings, you know, and I like to paint people in my neighborhood, and I like to paint just strangers. So when people think about, okay, well, am I going to purchase a painting of a stranger? You know, most people want that type of work to be more personal. So for me, it's more of like this inner currency. Like it's almost like the process pays me. I need time in that studio, and I need time away, and I need quiet to be able to work on my work. And I'm not even in the realm of selling. You know, my time is so limited. I have my full-time teaching job. I have my family. So where I am right now is, honestly, I'm not even thinking about selling. I'm just more in the process of keeping up my momentum so that I can continue to work. You know, that momentum is my currency.
I was going to say, it sounds like for you, you've got to find a way to be in the studio.
I have to.
You have to.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's the case for everyone around the table. Mm-hmm. It's just not as easy to move what I'm producing as it might be for things that can be, you know, produced a little bit more readily.
So therefore, income streams, you find them in other ways, but they're still connected to art.
Right. Right. And this is something that I tell my students. You know, it's like you have to think about what you want to do. If you want to just generally be in the arts field, then consider teaching. Consider arts administration. If you have to be working, then consider getting a job, you know, and not to say anything, but consider maybe getting a position at Target, wherever, so that you don't have to have a whole lot of work to do outside of work, and you can dedicate all of your outside time to producing.
Okay. Well, Ben, what about you? What is the plan of attack in terms of moving stuff and making an income?
Yeah, my plan has been to diversify my income so that I can meet the most amount of people, thinking that I'll be able to sell if I can meet those people. So I've meet those people through in-person sales at workshops that I teach at art centers. I meet those people through social media and through my podcast, which people listen to and then get in touch with me and are interested in my work or the people that I interview's work. I've been an arts administrator, so I've worked in galleries and worked in art centers where people have gotten to know me through that. But my basic philosophy is that if I can get to know the people, that they will want to buy from me. So I try to just meet as many people as possible.
So Ben, just the other day, we were talking, I think we were talking about Current Scene, which launched last Friday in Rochester, Rochester's biennial. And now I'm had this opportunity to ask, amidst all of the work that artists have been doing in different media to put their work out there, sometimes in public spaces, sometimes in galleries, sometimes for sale, sometimes not, how artists feel if they visit with a friend and that friend's got like a print of Van Gogh. And I said, in the same way that I had a cocktail drink maker once tell me that like he can't take it when he's out with a friend and they order like an Appletini, you know, like because it's like offensive to the craft. Yeah, but everybody at the table said, no, it's fine. If you want that Van Gogh print, you know, go for it. How do you feel, Ben, when either it's a print, sort of a mass-produced print, or someone has art, but it's by a big name and it maybe overlooks some local talent? Do you give everybody the space to have whatever they like, or do you think people are missing opportunities to support artists in different ways?
Yeah, I don't fault people for liking Van Gogh or Picasso, any of the more famous European artists. I think that a lot of times those people function as the gateway drug to your local art scene. So people might buy the print and then they might say, oh, there's a sale going on down at, you know, Flower City Art Center. I should go to that because I enjoy art now. So you got to get into it somehow. So however people get into the arts, don't fault them for that.
Okay. Atisha, how do you feel about when you bump into people who've got prints or, you know, mass-produced stuff?
Yeah, I think Ben said it well. It's, you know, it's whatever gets the person into the art. And then it's just like the clouds part, and then you can see, like, the full picture.
Well, that's the ideal. Does that happen?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think something has to get somebody interested. And just like how we say, well, shop local, then a person becomes aware, well, I could buy this mass-produced Van Gogh print, or I could go to Flower City Arts or visit my local artist and support a local artist by buying their work. You know, I think people have to come to that awareness.
Okay, fair enough. Chris?
I think that's one of the reasons I really like doing art fairs, because they are a little more accessible. My price points are pretty low. I mean, you can get a reproduction for $20, or you can get even an original for $50 from me. And I feel like I'm maybe the next step to collecting art. So maybe for someone who's never bought an original piece of artwork, mine is affordable and accessible. And then that gets them thinking about like collecting and finding other, local artists.
Just that word, I think, is important to kind of key in that word. Just the word collecting carries like this aura of, well, you got to have wealth.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the notion of local artists whose work can be outstanding that you can find for $20, $50, $100, not hundreds or thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and maybe they will eventually get there, but and people don't think of it that way. I mean, I have people who come in and they're like, oh yeah, I have that, that, and that. And I'm like, oh, you're a collector now. And
I'm a collector?
Like, oh, wait, what?
People would not think of themselves as a collector.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so, would you like more people to think of themselves as collectors?
Oh, heck yeah. Definitely.
I think that's totally interesting. Kelly, what about you? Does it bother you when you see friends who've got the mass-produced stuff?
It doesn't bother me. I mean, I think you should surround yourself with things that make you happy. But I will say, in my house, I have both mass-produced and handmade things. Probably the handmade mugs have won out over the mass-produced mugs over the years, because I just enjoy holding something that someone else has made and put time into. So I've sort of gravitated more towards those things.
Okay. Peter, you fail students if they've got Van Gogh?
No. And we have a lot of non-handmade things at the house. And this is maybe in some way a struggle that my wife and I have, where sometimes I always want to fill the house with handmade things. But there is a value to not always having something with such a deep sort of emotional connection to you as the person who's collected it. I subscribe to having both, because I think, especially in the field of ceramics, in the field of utilitarian work, the experience of drinking out of a cup changes dramatically when it's handmade, in ways that you can only really understand when you use it, and in ways that through its use you're connected to someone else or an entire culture. So there's something totally beautiful about that, and that's sort of what is promoted through the use of these handmade objects.
I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on that. I mean, you started to do it, but I want to hear more about why the experience of drinking from a cup that's handmade is different.
Yeah, well, There is a lot in the materiality of the work, of clays, of how clays are used, of the regionality of clays, of, say, Ben Carter's approach and his interest in maiolica and how that might be differentiated from someone's approach to wood firing. Or there's a lot of locality to the way that people handle the material, and then that coupled with their personality creates tendencies in the work that are very unlike, say, this beautiful This American Life cup right here, right? There's a difference in that
calling
work.
Us out.
Yeah, we will get you a handmade mug. But you know that experience, and I guess this is Flower City Pottery Invitational Week, so this is a week in which we are sort of celebrating the object, the handmade object. And when you go to this place and you experience the thousands of pots that will be there in the Flower City Art Center, you will hold the work and you will just feel something different through it.
So let's hit it. The fifth annual Flower City Pottery Invitational is October 10th through the 13th at the Firehouse Gallery. That's at 713 Monroe Avenue. Mm-hmm. What do you want the community to know about what you're going to find here?
Well, including Ben Carter. We have 20 national and internationally renowned potters who are bringing each 70 to 100 pieces. So anywhere between 1,400 and 2,000 pots are there to be held and to be collected, everything from $20 pieces to maybe $1,000 or more pieces of work. It is, in my mind, an opportunity to visit sort of a living museum, to walk through and experience culture, experience the world through ceramics, to hold the work, to communicate with these people who, like Ben, will be there and are incredibly warm and welcoming, and to sort of just understand a little something about craft, craft in the 21st century.
So the event's going to include a special artist reception, sale, pottery exhibitions.
Friday evening, 6 to 8 p.m., and tickets can be purchased in advance through the website or at the door.
RochesterArts.org?
Sounds right.
Yes, that's correct.
Kelly's like, that is right.
RochesterArts.org.
Doesn't sound right. RochesterArts.org.
Yes, Friday night is the ticketed event, so that's the $20 event where you get the first shot at the work, and then Saturday and Sunday it's completely free.
Okay, and the workshops Thursday, Friday are ticketed as well, is that right?
Yes, there are longer workshops on Thursday and Friday. I believe the ones tomorrow are sold out, but there are still some spots available in the Friday workshops.
If this is a successful event, what's it look like, Kelly?
What does the successful event look like?
Yeah, tell me what success is for the next 4 days for you guys.
Having the studio completely packed with people who are excited to see all of these handmade cups. The artists will be there, so people will be able to talk to them and ask them about how they're making their living as an artist. There will be, like you said, many workshops and demonstrations. The demonstrations on Saturday and Sunday are free, so you could go in and actually see people making the work, working, like showing you how they make what they make.
All right, very
answering
good.
Questions.
And Peter, you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say it is a fundraiser for the Flower City Art Center, and we have to think about the value of arts education for people of all ages, of gender, ethnicity, race, everything. Anyone can walk in the door and can receive an education in art and craft through that institution. And so a successful event is, of course, selling the work a little bit, because that sort of helps us fund the people who've traveled from as far as California, and then also to fund the center so that it can continue to do really fantastic things for our community.
All right, it's RochesterArts.org. Information, schedule of events, tickets, and more if you want to be a part of the fifth annual Flower City Pottery Invitational that starts tomorrow and runs through Sunday. So thanks for the information there. After our only break of the hour, speaking of that idea of educating the community at all ages, we've got a question from listeners about whether kids are being taught to do art and to work with their hands like they used to. We're going to hit that with our guests when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the film Joker opened in theaters last Friday, but it was the center of controversy even before audiences had a chance to see it. The film tells the story of a man struggling with mental health issues who is moved to violence. Critics say the film draws a false parallel between mental illness and violence, and meanwhile, theaters are stepping up security measures ahead of all screenings. So let's talk Joker Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. So As we talk to artists, I want to remind you why we're here. We had a note from one of our friends, Amanda Chestnut, over at Flower City Arts Center, and who's really one of the smartest people in Rochester, by the way, and had this idea of having a conversation about 5th Annual Flower City Pottery Invitational, which you just heard all about. And we thought, what a great hook to have this conversation about making a career as an artist, what it means to be an art city, what it means to support artists, and in so many ways, the work and the lives and sometimes, yes, the struggle of struggling artists, what it looks like. So we have an outstanding panel of five discussing that this hour. And one of our listeners wanted to know if kids are still being taught, I think responding to the idea of making cups. So I'll start there with Peter and Kelly, and I'll ask all five of you this, though. Are kids being taught at young ages, and I'm probably thinking middle school, high school, but maybe even elementary school, to do art, and art is so many different things. Obviously, kids are being taught to draw a little bit, but painting, different mediums, the clay work that I can remember, has it changed? What do we know about that? Let me start here with Peter. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think in elementary school, it's still happening the way that it should. My daughter is in Cobbles, and her teacher, Miss Vatican, is phenomenal, and I go into the classroom at least once a year, if not more, if I can. And really, kids, despite the amount of time they're able to spend in the classroom at that age, are given a really great education. And I think there are great teachers in middle school and high school, but I think the opportunities, the funding is starting to be cut. And this is really the problem. The problem is in college education or the professional marketplace, because all of those things are there, they're viable, they're healthy, but it's where the money comes into those classrooms and how creativity is funded in middle school and high school that I feel is creating some problems.
Is it being squeezed out for time because teachers have a lot of tests to deal with and other things, or is it money? No. What's the issue?
Well, part of it is a STEM education issue. Okay. Right. And I say this, I work at a STEM school, RIT, but President Munson is very interested in the arts and their relationship to STEM.
I suspect they tell you work at a STEAM school.
They probably do at this point. But, you know, it is by its very name, a technology oriented school.
Yeah.
So, you know, part of it is that sort of interest in that type of education, and part of it is just that there isn't enough money going around anywhere. And I think that we are often fixated on this concept of the struggling artist, but there's the struggling lawyer, there are a lot of professions right now that are having hard times because, economically speaking, we're in a really fascinating period of American history.
Okay. Kelly, how do you see it?
So I graduated high school in 2006, and I had the opportunity through elementary, middle, and high school to take art classes. I don't have children of my own, so I'm not very plugged into the current school system. So I can't really answer what's happening with that.
Okay. All right. Let me turn to Chris then. What do you think?
I don't have kids either, so I'm not too super plugged in. I do teach a five-week class at Fairport High School every year. They have this amazing program that's been going on for like 30 years where they bring in different artists from the community to teach different medium. And it's for kids who are generally juniors or seniors and have to apply to be in the program. I have a feeling that's a real exception in most schools. So I would say, I guess it depends where you're going to school. I think even in a great high school like that, there's been some major cutbacks and what kids are getting exposed to art-wise.
Okay. Tasia?
So this is a hot point for me because I'm always shocked at how many students I have coming in, particularly to my Art Essentials classes, the open art elective at MCC, and how many of them say, I haven't taken an art class since middle school, or I hadn't taken one at all throughout high school. And that's really concerning to me because I really believe that to promote this sort of whole brain mind and whole brain thinking, people need, students, kids need those tactile experiences from very early on. And, you know, we're talking about middle school, but children need to have their hands in clay, to be playing with foam or whatever from first, in a 1 year old, 2 years old, to really begin to make that connection and to allow the right side of the brain to be as strong as that left side. the left side is going to be strong. We all have to operate on that left side of the brain, right? Going somewhere, navigating somewhere, touching a phone and having it do what you want it to do. Where we're lacking is, again, that creative side. So I do have children, and the art teachers do a great job. But personally, if I were to make a criticism, I would love to see kids have an opportunity just for more free creating, not to make this beautiful giraffe, which I have framed at home, not to make this gorgeous thing that is more of like a formula, but more, here's some paint, here's some pencils, do whatever you want. Because again, that strengthens that spontaneous side of the brain.
Well, if you are encountering students who are telling you routinely, I haven't had an art class since middle school, or I've never really had an art class, do you think part of it is because, sort of think about what Peter said about this emphasis on STEM, probably going back a good decade. I mean, certainly the Obama administration, understandably so, put a lot of emphasis on math and science, thinking about career readiness and future careers. But has that swung in a way that has sort of signaled that art is less than or is less valuable?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
I believe that we're there. Right. So when there are cuts to be made, when there is time to have to shave off of the school day, the music and the art get the cuts in. And my kids come home to me because it's so important to them. They come to me and say, Mom, now we have 30 minutes for art and for music. So the things that really are what attract my children personally are the things that are just sort of being shaved off of the school day. So I do believe it's this STEM focus. I do believe it's, you know, that traditional, when there are cuts, they come to art and music first.
Well, maybe we should do just a breakdown of the average school and how they have kids spend the day. Hmm. Kids get like 10, 12 minutes for lunch. They can barely get through lunch, let alone finding time for art, music.
Right.
And teachers, I'm not condemning or blaming. I know you got a lot of things you have to do, but it's just interesting to see the way we've prioritized and then deprioritized certain things.
Right. Yeah. And can I just say one more
thing? Yeah, please.
This is always interesting to me. We talk about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and these people that were like the fathers of this mobile technology. And I'll tell people, and I'll tell my students, they sent their children to Waldorf schools. And Waldorf schools are schools in which there are no screens at all to be seen, and people are using their hands. Because they knew that to be able to innovate when their kids are adults, they would have had to have more of a whole brain education. And that's how to start. When you're in school, 9 to 5, whatever the hours, to be using your hands and not so much disconnected by being on a screen.
That's interesting because we think about political leaders and sometimes we analyze where people choose to send their kids as revelatory. And it can be. And in this case, it's sort of feels like it's on the mark there, isn't it, to say if they sent their kids to screenless schools, what is it telling us?
Right, right. Whereas with us, we cheer and congratulate our schools and their administrators when we get a grant for iPads for all the kids to be using an iPad. And again, I want to echo what you said. This is not to criticize teachers, administrators out there. I know you guys are working really hard, but I think we need to focus more on that whole brain development.
Interesting.
And art is important to
Before that. I get Ben, I know Peter looked like you want to jump back in here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do want, nothing is as black and white. Nothing is set in stone. Fairport, John, who teaches in Fairport, is a phenomenal, phenomenal teacher. And when you go to Fairport High School, you have access to the complete history of our craft ceramics through this phenomenal educator who has a lot of resources. And there's a big following of students that have interest in it. In Penfield High School, there's a clay club. There's a lot of interest. It's not as though the opportunities aren't there. There's a bigger picture of how time is being spent that isn't faculty specific or teacher specific. It has to do with scheduling and with a general assessment of value in education. And more to your point.
Okay. Ben Carter, where do you fall on this one?
Yeah, I grew up in Virginia where the arts were supported when I was in school. This was, quite a few decades ago. My firsthand experience is that I would not be an artist if I didn't have high school art teachers that told me I could do this as a living and encouraged me to both have creative play, like just explore the aesthetics of art, but also that this could be a viable way to make a living. But I wanted to expand out on this question just a little bit and talk to the people that are listening to this and mention the effects that art has that are not economic. So, for instance, when human beings work with their hands, there's a reduction in anxiety. There's a reduction in a lot of the problems that we see high school kids having in terms of anxiety, stress, tension, all these things that they're suffering from. Art, it can actually be the antidote to that. So if you're listening to this on the radio right now and you have a kid that is anxious and that's having these issues, art, or encourage your school system to keep the arts in, because that's one of the positive effects of those programs, both fine arts, music, theater, all of those things have been shown to reduce the stress levels of people that are practicing them.
Okay. Tisha, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I just want to add to what Ben just said. And I think that's why we're seeing unprecedented growth at Flower City Arts. I went to put my name on a list for a shelf there, and there are 23 people on the list. Mm-hmm. And Flower City Arts, I mean, they have literally had to expand to add more kilns, to knock down a wall so there's more room. I think generally people in the community are finding solace and finding therapy through using their hands, particularly in this case, playing with clay.
And we offer classes for all ages, ages 3 through 100. So we have anyone can come take a class.
Well, I'm thinking about classes and what's available, and I'm wondering, let me read an email and I'll kind of get back to the point that was on my mind for adult learning. Jessica writes to us and says, just quick plug for Genesee Valley Council on the Arts. Artists from Livingston and Monroe County can apply now for New York State grant funding. The organization supports lots of really important programs in our community. And the Rochester Brainery has a course called Business Development for Artists and Makers coming up soon. That's worth checking out. That comes from Jessica. Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate that. And, you know, thinking about what the Brainery or Flower City Arts, wherever the case may be, you know, it's one thing to give adults a chance, but I'm thinking about language. When we try to learn a foreign language, it's easier for kids to start because kids are still developing the brain. And if a kid starts at 3, 4, 5, 6, they got a better chance than if they start at 34 or 35 or 36. And Atisha, on that subject of sort of right brain, left brain, can we reactivate it as adults if you see it turned off?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be a little rusty, right, to get it going again. But that's where that 10,000-hour rule comes into play. Not that you have to put in 10,000 hours, but obviously the more time and dedication you put into it, the more muscle memory takes over, whether you're throwing on the wheel or whether you're using paint or printmaking. So definitely not, you know, I wouldn't tell anyone, okay, yeah, forget about that because you're 34. It's not so much about being proficient or about one day making money. It's about what can you get, what's the benefit right now, and oftentimes it's just that art therapy that can be applied to oneself just in the making. So absolutely, I would tell someone to pick it up at any age.
Okay, Chris, do you believe that? Can reactivate it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I feel like it's impossible for me. I feel like I might be the only one who is just lost, you know, fully lost and fully calcified, the part of my brain that might have been artistic at some point.
No, it drives me crazy when people are like, I'm just not creative. I'm like, everybody's creative in their own way. And you don't have to be like naturally talented and be a brilliant painter to start. I mean, that's, you're taking the class to learn the process and maybe gain some appreciation and, you know, use different parts of your brain.
Well,
absolutely.
You know what, Ben Carter? I bet you so much of it is when you find the Atishas and the Peters who are the outstanding teachers who can not only teach concepts but reach people, because I'm sure somebody could uncalcify my artistic brain. Ben, do you think it's possible?
I think it's possible. I think you're more creative than you're giving yourself credit. If you can match your clothes in the morning, then you are creative. You have already made aesthetic decisions.
Please do not. I'm glad you can't see my socks right now then. Kelly, do you think people are reachable? You know, you're in your 30s now. I mean, if you've got friends in their 30s who say to you, look, I'm just not an artist. I could never be an artist. What would you say to that?
I would say they're wrong. I think you should come take a class at the Flower City Arts Center.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm in my 40s now, which is code for too late, Peter.
Never too late.
No. There's this gentleman, Jack, we will call him. Jack was an engineer. He had an interest in ceramics that led him through high school, and he his parents weren't incredibly supportive, so he instead went into the field of engineering. He had an entire career, and late in his career, he went to one of my workshops and said, I really want to get back into ceramics. And so for a few years, I've been emailing back and forth with him. He's gone to a number of workshops, and he's now just starting his own sort of career as an artist and at 65. And so it's never too late, and the work is looking good, and he's problem solving, and he's on it. Jack is doing well. The key thing here is the difference between having to restart it or not has everything to do with the way that parents are involved with kids as a young age. So it's not even a classroom thing. I feel very fortunate that my mom just looked at what I was doing and said, he has an interest in this. He really clearly, there's something profound about his relationship to this. And she just, no questions, just supported it, pushed me through it, said, whatever you need to make this happen, we'll make this happen. And so that's why I went to college for it. And there was never pressure on it being a job. It was only a thing that was of interest to me. And so I was able to do it at a young age.
I love that story. And I think that's a great little way to put a coda on this program. So you just heard Peter describing why you felt supported, and maybe it was cultivated, that skill or that desire or that ability that you had early. It's probably different for everybody. Let me kind of continue around the table. Kelly, when did you know that this could be viable, or when did you feel like it was something you should pursue?
So I had done pottery just as a hobby all throughout college, and then I graduated with my English degree, and I decided that there was nothing else I enjoyed more than pottery. So I took a few classes through the university. And one day, I think I was like poking holes into a vessel that I'd made. And I was like, I could just do this every day, all day, every day. And I think I would be happy.
What did people around you say to that idea?
They said, go for it. I mean, my parents were very supportive.
Great.
Yeah. I never met any resistance with it.
That's great. What about you, Chris?
I mean, I had taken a break from college, and I went back to school for graphic design, and just very randomly found letterpress printing through the Flower City Art Center and started doing that on the side and started doing some like festivals and things. And then in 2015, I got laid off from my design job of 10 years. So then it became I won't say obvious choice, because I still struggled with it for several months, but finally was like, you know, now is the time to give this a try. And it's been going well since.
Did you consult with people around you? Did people?
Oh, heck yeah.
What did they say about the idea of, oh, you're going to be an artist now?
Well, I mean, I consulted with other artists who were doing it full time,
sure,
and other artists who were maybe not full time. But I also was really lucky, because I was on unemployment, and there's a program through New York State where instead of going out to look for a job, you can apply and basically work on starting your business. So I did that. They required a certain number of hours of, I think they called it entrepreneurial training. So I took classes through SCORE and through some other places, and it really helped prepare me to be successful at this.
Okay, Natasha?
Yeah, my experience is similar to Peter's, in that I think as soon as my mom saw that there was something, you know, there was something with me and pencils and paper, and she just encouraged me. You know, it was never like a questioning, like, oh my gosh, if she goes this route, she won't make any money. She was just constantly encouraging me. You know, if I wanted a sketchbook, come on, Mom, let's go. Let's go to the art store. And she was right there. In addition to incredibly encouraging parents, I had really encouraging teachers. And one of those teachers, Kathy Fine, and she's listening. Hey, Kathy. She was my middle school art teacher at Number 3 School. And she was another cheerleader that came along. So I think it's critical that young people in the arts have those cheerleaders. And even if they don't, that they find some way to be sort of self-motivated to continue with their craft.
That's great. Ben, what about you?
Yeah, I was fortunate to learn to throw on the potter's wheel specifically in high school. And I was hooked from the beginning. You know, in ceramics, we talk about it, that people get the bug, like it's almost like a sickness. but I knew from the first week, basically since my first week throwing, and I even told my parents this, I'm going to be a potter. And thankfully, they encouraged me, but they also encouraged me by giving me other opportunities to learn. So, you know, they had me look up, well, who are the artists in the area that I could go talk to? What school should I go to? Because as a teenager, I knew I loved the process, but I didn't really know how do you actually make this work. And thankfully, I had other artists that became mentors that explained, like, if you want to be a potter, you need to do X, Y, and Z and kind of progress in your skills and your understanding of business. And, you know, I'm really thankful to those mentors for their help in encouraging me.
Ben, thanks for the time this hour, by the way. We really appreciate that. I know everyone's excited here for the 5th Annual Flower City Pottery Invitational. Thank you for joining us on the program this hour, Ben.
Yes, thank you very much, Evan.
And as we get ready to wrap here, Peter Pincus, I'm going to turn to you to tell us one more time the 5th Annual Flower City Pottery Invitational, the details. Go ahead.
Whew. Okay, 20 potters, workshops starting actually today at RIT, Sam Chung and Rebecca Chapel. So 20 potters are coming. They are each bringing 70 to 100 pieces. So you have 1,400 to 2,000 pots, cups to large vessels, teapots, plates, things of service, things of containment that you can hold on to and that you can experience. You can talk to the artists, and then hopefully you bring it home. You support your local art organization, the Flower City Art Center. Kelly Justice.
Kelly, go ahead.
Yes, come to the Flower City Art Center this weekend.
Online at rochesterarts.org. And where, by the way, is the Flower City Art Center?
It is at 713 Monroe Avenue, right next to Dogtown.
Thank you for being here, and good luck with the Invitational, and have a great time over the next 4 days or so. Actually, really, as you said, starting today, but thanks to everyone. So Peter, thank you. Kelly, thank you. Our thanks to Chris Charles, printmaker, graphic designer, and art instructor. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And Atisha Benjamin is a painter, ceramics artist, professor of art at MCC, and a creative consultant. Thank you, Atisha.
Hey, thanks for having me.
A wonderful conversation this hour. Our thanks to, I saw Don volunteering today. I saw Emma Ray, interning. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. Thanks to Barsook Records for the music. And I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.